All right. Good morning, everyone. This meeting of the House Community and Regional Affairs Committee will now come to order. It is 8:02 a.m. Thursday, April 13th, 2023 in Copper Room 124. Members present are Vice Chair McCabe, Representative McCabe, Representative Putkatuk, Representative Ruffridge, Representative Himshute, Representative Mears, and myself, Representative McCormick, Chair. Let the record reflect that we have everyone here and we have a quorum to conduct business. Please take this time to silence your cell phones, ham radios, or anything else that you might have for the duration of this meeting. Before we begin, I would like to thank Linda Jensen, the House CNRA Secretary from Records, and Kelsey Riker from the Juneau LIO for staffing the committee today. Today we have a presentation from the Department of Corrections and three bills. First up is an overview from an overview presentation from the Department of Corrections. Second, we will have our second hearing on House Bill 70 by Representative Tomaszewski regarding municipal property tax exemptions with invited testimony. Third, we will hear House Bill 134 by Representative Colombe regarding property transfer tax. And finally, we will hear Senate Bill 77 by Senator Dunbar, a bill on municipal property tax exemptions, tax on blighted property, which is the companion bill to House Bill 84, which, if you recall, we heard a couple of committees back. But we will now get started with the presentation, and so will you please turn we'll turn our attention to the presentation from the Department of Corrections. Commissioner Jennifer Winkleman and Deputy April Wilkerson, would you please come forward, put yourself on the record, and please begin your presentation. And thank you very much for being here this morning.
Great. Good morning. For the record, my name is Jen Winkleman. I'm the Commissioner Designate for the Department of Corrections. Just want to thank the committee and the chair for having us here this morning to do a department overview. I know that we have done several of these in different committees, and our hope is to provide you that 30,000-foot view and get into some questions with regard to policy and such. I do have at the table with me Deputy Commissioner April Wilkerson and Deputy Commissioner Jake Wyckoff. Both will be providing some testimony today. But also in the room and on the phone are the many esteemed members of our executive team. We have directors of our divisions. They'll be our lifelines for questions. I thank them for being here and supporting the process as well. So with that, we will get started. So the Department of Corrections was originally housed as a division under the Department of Health and Social Services. In 1984, it broke away and became its own department under then Governor Sheffield. Our mission is grounded in the Constitution to provide secure confinement, reformative programming, and a process of supervised release. We have just over 2,100 positions within the department, a budget of about $419 million. And the little chart at the bottom there shows our four primary divisions within the department and kind of where they touch on the mission statement, whether it's secure confinement, supervised release, or the reformative programming. The next slide is DOC at a glance. What I will note is that Alaska is one of seven unified states. What that means is that our jails and prisons are under one umbrella. If you think of a state that is not unified, often their jails will be housed in a court system by a sheriff's office, maybe a municipality will be holding that responsibility. But the Alaska Department of Corrections encompasses all of that. Also makes a really unique, sometimes some unique challenges, if you will, because we have that unsentenced population housed with our sentenced population or under the same structure, if you will. We're going to touch on that unsentenced and sentenced population here later in the presentation. As I know, I've had the honor of speaking with all of you, DOC books in nearly 30,000 people into custody in a year. That being said, we have approximately 17,000 that are unique offenders, meaning they've come in one time. But that gives a big, a large number that come in more than once. And that's what this, that bullet point is showing. I just would point out at the beginning of this calendar year, the department was responsible for nearly 11,000 folks in our care and custody. And that's going to include those that are in custody of the 4,400 as noted on here, those that are on electronic monitoring out in our communities, those that are in our halfway houses, those that are on probation and parole, and those that are on pretrial supervision status. So at any given time, the department is responsible for many individuals, more than just are in our facilities. And this slide is our organizational chart. It gives an overview of the structure of the department. You'll note that the parole board is on the top and kind of connected by a dotted line. And that's because the Board of Parole is housed budgetarily under the Department of Corrections, but it is fully autonomous. The staff in that unit point to the parole board, and the parole board is appointed by the governor, approved by the legislature. I'm always proud to say, and I may have shared this with you, when I look at this executive team setup, we have a combined total of nearly 150 years of corrections experience within our team, which is really remarkable. And with that, I will turn this over to Deputy Commissioner Jake Wyckoff to touch on the Division of Institutions.
Good morning. For the record, Jacob Wyckoff, currently serving as a Deputy Commissioner over Operations, Division of Institutions, and Health and Rehabilitative Services. If I may, Mr. Chair, have just a bit of latitude to thank you all for this opportunity to talk about these topics today, these two divisions. I thank the Commissioner as well. And a little bit of background about myself. I haven't been here before this body before, so I would say that although at the end of the day today I serve as a deputy commissioner, I will be pulling from experience as a correctional officer. I've spent approximately the last 2.5 decades performing work as a correctional officer in various different forms and fashions. I also would be remiss if I didn't take the opportunity to acknowledge the staff. You know, we're talking about some big assets here in these two divisions, and the most important of those would be our staff, the correctional officers, the probation officers, the mental health clinicians, the nurses, the doctors, the health practitioners, our maintenance staff, our kitchen staff, the various different administrative support personnel, our planners and technicians. Those folks keep our basic security profile not only functional and intact, but effective. And I want to just take a moment to recognize those folks. And I also would, although I feel like I'll be presenting some information, welcome a conversation. I prefer a conversation. I will do my best to answer questions. And then we have some very smart folks behind us and on the telephone should we need them. So without further ado, I'll get going. This slide here talks about the Division of Institutions, arguably the largest in the department. It contains 13 correctional centers. They are scattered throughout the state of Alaska, as far west as Bethel, as far north and west as Nome, throughout the interior and Fairbanks. We have several in the Anchorage Matsu area, as well as technically three on the Kenai Peninsula, and in the southeast in here in Juneau, as well as Ketchikan. We also have community residential centers, also known as halfway houses, several of those throughout the state as well. This division houses sentenced electronic monitoring and our inmate transportation. So inmate transportation works hand in hand with our classification and furlough unit. Those folks designate inmates to assist us with providing the best housing options for a particular individual, and then transportation assists us with making those moves happen. And we work collectively with the Department of Public Safety. They delegate some authority to us to move folks for population management as well as our medical appointments and things of that nature. The slide here represents our facility capacity for our state correctional facilities. On the date this was pulled was the 1st of January, 2023. What's important to note here is you'll see each one of the sites listed, and you'll see a gray bar. You'll also see a yellow bar and a red bar. The gray bar was our current capacity at that moment in time, and the yellow bar is our general capacity. And general capacity is the general population beds that we have available at each of our sites. And the red line is what we refer to as maximum capacity, which is our general population beds and half of our segregation beds. And the point I want to make note of on this slide is that not only on this date were each of the sites under capacity, we are holding that number. And this is no mistake. This was not an accident. We collectively as a department under the commissioner's direction went and really looked at our population. And we tasked our classification folks and our transportation officers, as well as our institutional probation officers, to look at the counts and get every single site below capacity. And we were able to do that, and we were able to hold that. Why did we do that? What that does, we believe, and we are starting to see this, is it creates a less stress environment. It can help with our staff in managing the stressors. It can also help with the inmate population, some of those stressors there. And statistically, it provides a safer environment for not only the staff, but the inmates that work there, or the inmates that reside with us.
Representative Hemshute.
Thank you. Through the chair, I just have two, I think, quick questions. One is, I appreciate that emphasis on safety and protection and comfort. And so would you place a higher priority on being incarcerated near family or lowering numbers? So, for example, if a facility, I'll just take Ketchikan, is it more important to keep people close to their family or to lower your numbers in Ketchikan? How would you make that decision?
It's a good question. Thank you. Through the chair, Representative Hemshute?
Correct.
Thank you. We do collectively as a department try to keep folks close to home. Historically, right, wrong, or indifferent, many years ago, I would say that our largest facility was in Arizona, and later on it was in Colorado. And we all put a lot of effort into bringing those folks back here to the state of Alaska. Those factors are put into place for the decision making. At the end of the day, we do want to keep our sites below capacity. I am recalling a situation where a person that is incarcerated did let us know, we do our best to keep them in the site closest to their family network. We do see how that is an important piece to ultimately that person's overall wellness.
Follow up.
Thanks. Through the chair, one other question I have is, we know the courts processed very few or had a reduced rate of processing cases through COVID, and they're coming back online and catching up. Are these numbers, are we going to get to capacity? Is there any way to predict, or are the people who are already facing those kinds of charges in your care?
The chair, Representative Hemshute, that is an interesting question. From my perspective, do you want to pull data or you want me to take a stab at it? I got it. Maybe.
Thanks.
So There will be a point in time, and I couldn't tell you right here today, when those lines will intersect, meaning overall capacity and our ability to house. And I would, in straight face, say that that is into the future some. Interestingly enough, we did put Palmer Correctional Center online back in August of 2021, so that did add approximately 504 beds. You'll also note that Palmer's higher. That is intentional. Palmer Correctional Center is a place where the person, most of those folks are at the end of their incarceration. So that we've got a medium site there, and we've got a minimum site there, and we have programming there. So as the person comes through the system, Palmer would be a stop where one might stop and do some time to get back into society. We also have another site here locally where we reduce the bed count by 102 because of the mechanical issue there. I'm not sure if I answered your question, but I did honestly.
Quick follow-up.
Please follow up.
Okay, sorry. Through the chair. I guess what I'm getting at is I appreciate that these are below the maximum capacity. I'm wanting to look into the future and somewhat into the crystal ball to see, do we have the facilities we need in 10 years or 20 years? Because it takes at least that long if we're going to make any big changes. So I guess that's kind of the question.
Yes, through the chair, I would like to punt over to DC Wilkerson.
Good morning. For the record, my name is April Wilkerson, Deputy Commissioner for the Department of Corrections. Through the chair to Representative Hemshoot. I believe what you're asking is the prison population, what is it going to do, and are we sufficiently, do we have sufficient capacity to absorb that? We do project that eventually there will be the need in the future. Right now, we're looking at what is that going to look like. We did a projections with COVID, with changes in statutory laws and sentence lengths, we currently are projecting that that line will be crossed and we should be looking at other options because we will exceed the capacity based on our current population projections after 2027. However, that we continue to look at all of our available options, whether that's the halfway house, remodeling current existing space. This chart does also reflect there's currently 102 beds that are not reflected on here that we've taken offline because of the damage that has occurred at Lemon Creek Correctional Center. So as those beds come back online, our capacity will increase by about 100 beds there. And then we continue to look at all of our facilities for optional options for expansions or renovations to expand that bed capacity, as well as our community placements to ensure that we're appropriately using those community placements in a safe fashion. Thank you.
Vice Chair McCabe.
Thank you. So Ms. Wilkerson, it's probably for you, but is the prison population, how do you track it? You track it by state population. So if the state population goes up, you just know that you're going to have a certain number of more people in guess, if you will, or do you track it by economics? So as the economic downturn happens, or some sort of like a 2008 scenario, does the prison population go up? Be interesting to know that. I think, and I didn't see it in here. So maybe if you have a spreadsheet or something, you must have some sort of projection based on what you just said.
Through the chair to Representative McCabe, we do. And we actually do have our chief researcher here in the audience with us as well. We take a look at what is happening actually with our population. We consider legislation that has changed. We will take a look at whether it's during COVID, those factors, what is happening in the communities in the various areas. And so it's really a global factor, but our actual current population is based on the trends that we are currently experiencing. It's a really rough estimate because we don't have 5 years worth of pretty steady. It's been, as the commissioner has talked previously, we had Senate Bill 91, and then we had a reversal, and then we had COVID, and there has been a lot of factors that had played into our current population projections.
Thanks.
Please continue.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. For the record, Deputy Commissioner Jake Wyckoff. This next slide here represents our prison population by legal status. The purpose of this, give just a moment, there we go. The purpose of this here is to show that our unsentenced population exceeds our sentenced population. In 2021 to 2022, we can see that that did go up. Yesterday at 8 o'clock in the morning, we were at 54% unsentenced. In this slide here, our prison population by offense class is a breakdown of the previous slide. Each of the crimes here by category. And of note, we did take the most serious charge. So the most serious charge that a person is incarcerated on is reflected in this graph or in this chart. And a person may have, you know, a few others along with that most serious charge. That is a possibility. Moving on to the Division of Health and Rehabilitation Services, referred to as HARS. That can be a bit of an acronym there, H-A-R-S. This division here services the population. We are constitutionally and statutorily mandated to provide timely access to essential health care. We use an evidence-based approach, and we follow the National Commission's correctional health care guidance and standards. In this division, there's multiple shops underneath it. We have the domestic violence program, reentry and recidivism. Take a moment here to note just a couple of those programs and the good work that folks have done, which is standardizing that curriculum. And we offer welding certifications, heavy equipment certifications, barber certifications, flaggers, as well as OSHA certs. And these are all skills that folks can learn, get certification in, and get a job. You know, if a person has a certification and is willing to work, you can get a job as a welder in Alaska. We also have under the division our substance abuse and behavioral health care, as well as the obvious, when you think about a division like this, the physical health care component. I would like to take a moment to recognize the hard work that this division has accomplished in collaboration with the Division of Institutions as well as the Mental Health Trust in Eagle River, our women's facility, Highland Mountain Correctional Center. We now have a fully functional integrated care unit, which is a mental health unit / infirmary specifically dedicated to the female population there at Highland. And this was many years in the making, and I'm proud to say that today it's up and running. I will extend an invitation if you all would like to come see. I'll personally give you a tour in my neighborhood.
For the record, my name is April Wilkerson. On this slide, this represents the Division of Pretrial Probation and Parole. We refer to this division as our DP3 division. It provides the core service of supervised community reentry and supervision. And that includes those individuals that are released in pretrial status by the court under those court conditions, as well as those individuals that have served their sentence and are released onto parole or onto probation as identified by the courts. This is the third largest division within the Department of Corrections, and it also houses and oversees the 15 regional and community jail contracts. We are working diligently to redefine the funding allocation and are working on reviewing those contracts for more appropriate. That program currently operates under standards that were set and established in 1994.
Representative Hemshute.
Thank you, through the chair. I appreciate your work on the community jails program. Do you have a timeline for when you might have those contracts? And maybe it's different for each community. But
through the chair to Representative Hemshute, we are wanting to get that in place at least tentatively by July 1st so they have a better idea of their funding allocation for the 24 budget.
Follow up.
Yeah, thank you, through the chair. Just, I'd be remiss not to point out that they're working on that budget right now. And so when you have this, hopefully by July 1st, will that be something that they'll know for their budget season for 25? Like, you'll be working ahead in the future? So we're wrapping up budget season 24 right now. So if you get information to them on July 1st, it's too late for 24. So... yeah, I just want to make sure that they have some certainty going forward. And I know that this is an area that you're working on, but if we work on it now, can we get some predictability in it?
Through the chair to Representative Hemshute, absolutely. That is what our goal is. We are hopeful that we have a solid amount by July 1st, and that will give them that steady, a better idea moving forward, and then continue to work with the legislature on full funding.
Okay, thank you.
The Board of Parole, which is housed budgetarily within the department, has two primary functions. The Board of Parole, they hold hearings and they review individuals' applications for parole. They also will hold hearings to address violations to determine whether an individual's parole will stay in place or whether it will be revoked and those individuals are returned to custody. I would also like to point out that the parole board members, statute requires appointments from each of the three judicial districts, and then there are two members that are appointed at large. And again, as the commissioner mentioned earlier, those are appointments made by the governor and then confirmed by the legislature. The Division of Administrative Services really provides services and support to all of the core functions of the department. That's the secure confinement, reformative programming, as well as supervised release. We have the standard, your routine administrative functions, which are within this division. That includes your budget and your finance, your payables. But our division also includes some statewide support that other administrative services divisions may not have. Our research and unit is housed within this division, as well as all of our inmate records, and we contain a central records repository for that. We also oversee the inmate DNA collection program. We do the collections and the tracking and the monitoring to ensure that we are meeting what the intent and the goals are and submitting that DNA to the public safety's crime lab appropriately. We also maintain a facility capital improvement unit within this division. We operate under a $500,000 delegation from the Department of Transportation to maintain our own maintenance and renovations and repairs. We do also work really collaboratively in a really good relationship with the Department of Transportation and receive a case-by-case one-time delegation for large projects that we feel we have the resources available to meet that. The Highland Mountain Integrated Care Unit is an example of that. We received a delegation from DOT, and that was an in-house managed project. We also maintain an OSHA compliance unit within this division. We work really closely with OSHA to try and avoid any violations or penalties. Sometimes we're not as successful, or sometimes we get a reduced fine, but we work in compliance to try and prevent those violations from occurring. Within the commissioner's office, we have a lot of different services and support and oversight. The commissioner provides that oversight to all of the areas within the department and the core services. But we have two primary major priority items that are pointed within the commissioner, and that's the recruitment and retention of our staff, and it's also our training academy to ensure that the training needs of our officers and our other staff are all met. And the needs are within the compliance and the directions that are set by the commissioner's office.
Vice Chair McCabe.
Thank you, Mr. Wilkerson. So what's your current vacancy percentage and maybe also overtime percentage? Do you have any idea, or would that have to be something you would get back to me with? Or maybe there's something right there. Well, what do you know? Help if I turn the page. Thanks.
No. Moving on to the next slide, I will have to get you the current. This information is as of January 1st, and so we will get back to the committee with the current vacancy. What I would say is on January 1st, we took a look at our budgeted versus our filled positions. We were at about a statewide, a 13% vacancy factor. I do want to really clarify that is all positions department-wide. When you break it down by job class, by correctional officer versus medical versus probation officer, the vacancy factors fluctuate, and they also fluctuate by location. At this point in time, on this date, I can tell you Seward, the correctional officer vacancies in the Seward correctional facility were pushing almost 40% vacancy. You can also notice in the medical and the mental health, it looks like we're slightly above our budgeted positions. That's because in our medical and mental health field, we utilize what's called on-call subfills, non-perm positions. And what we do is we will utilize those individuals that are signed up in those positions to meet vacancies while we go through the recruitment process to get the classified permanent position filled. In maintenance, we utilize contracts when we have a vacancy. It usually comes at a much higher cost because we are not able to do the preventative maintenance, and so it ends up deteriorating into a more of an emergency type situation. While we are recognizing our recruitment efforts and our vacancies and we're working diligently, the one thing I really wanted to point out on the slide is in looking at our data, in 2022, we hired 217 total employees. COs and POs specifically, we had 116 new correctional and probation officers. However, we had 170 that separated. So for a net loss of 54 officers. What we are working and trying to refocus on is our retention efforts to try and bring our staffing levels back up to an appropriate, more safe, and efficient status. And at this point, I'll turn it over to the commissioner for closing out.
For the record, Jen Winkleman. You know, I've had the privilege and honor of speaking with all of you, whether that's in your offices or in front of committees. And so I think you know, but I also think it's so important to state on the record. I'm very passionate about this department and the work that we do. Having spent over two decades in the work, I believe in it. I love the idea of the public safety and the rehabilitation efforts that take place. But quite frankly, what it is the staff that we work for. As I said, that we've got 2,100 staff within the department, and I would be remiss, like DC Wyckoff mentioned, to not give a shout out to them every single day. We deal with nearly 11,000 people within our facilities that, quite frankly, they don't want to be there. And it's tough work day in and day out. So when I speak of priorities for the department, I speak of priorities on behalf of the entire state, I really have to say that the number one that I have not wavered from is that got to make sure that we're taking care of the health and well-being of our staff. If we do that, they will take care of those that are in our care and custody better, I have no doubt. And so that is the absolute number one. And it's tough. The labor market's tough. Then you add the components of working in a facility where there's much more glamorous jobs than working in a jail day in and day out. So it is tough work, and I recognize that. So taking care of the staff so they can take care of those that are in our care is number one. The number two, that we get folks healthier on the way out. If we don't think of reentry as being part of public safety, we're missing the boat. We don't control who comes to us, but we can make a difference on those that are leaving our facilities. And sometimes that is looking at everything from the fact that they get a shower, or they are even all the way to being reunited with their children before they get released. So really working hard on getting folks healthier on the way out, out the door and back into our communities so that they don't come back. And then the last part is trying to identify efficiencies and resources. It's cliche as it sounds, if we do the same thing, we're going to get the same results. And so really diving in, I feel that I'm really of a benefit of having come up through the ranks in the department and seeing the way we do business, and really trying to figure out how we can implement efficiencies and resources to not only have our inmates leave us healthier, but then our staff safer. So constantly looking at those efficiencies and resources to make the department better, to ultimately reduce those recidivism rates. And that I'm steadfast in those three goals. I know they'll morph. I know that as ideas come forward, both from the legislature, our staff, and those in the community, we will morph into what that looks like. But if we take care of these three, I think that we will continue to make the difference that we're making. And it goes to the vacancy rates that we just talked about, and trying to keep staff and develop a culture that staff want to work there and want to be part of something bigger. So the goals, like I said, I haven't wavered from them, and I just try to reiterate them every chance that I get.
Representative Mears.
Thank you. I appreciate you guys coming back today, and I know we had gotten into some good conversations and talked a little bit about policy when you were here for the Budget Finance Subcommittee. This is probably a conversation for another day, because I know we've got a full agenda today. But one of our, I think, gifts and responsibilities as legislators is that we get to look at multiple departments. And as you mentioned during budget times, your downstream facilities are really the policies of other departments come and affect you. You know, a couple of our members are in Health and Human Services Commission. I've had some experience in the public health background. And we know that that's all, you know, that all feeds here. And our healthiest society is when you guys have less to do. So I find it's very interesting that you've got a chief researcher that's here with you today. And I think it would be a really good conversation about what are the things that we can be working on that we should be aware of that go into those factors that are bringing folks to you, and what we can do to keep that from happening. So like I said, bigger topic, you know, probably more than we can get into today, but I would love to have that conversation. Thank you, Chair.
Thank you, Representative Mears. Are there any other questions from the committee? We've got some time left, so I'm happy and welcome any questions, comments, or dialogue for the commission.
To Representative Mears, I just wanted to comment on that. And I when I mentioned the having, I definitely think that's a very huge conversation outside of this. That being said, I think about when I mentioned the comment about coming kind of up through the ranks and recognizing where gaps exist and things like that. One of the biggest things that was such an eye opener to me now being in this position was really the genuine need to work with those stakeholders outside. And, you know, you mentioned health and education, all of these pieces and parts. And I will say that, you know, I've had countless conversations with other commissioners on those same topics to try to figure out. And I'll use Department of Health, for example, and the Healthy Families Initiative, and really looking at where that ties into corrections. So I appreciate your comment. I do think it's a bigger conversation. But just want to recognize that working with those stakeholders has been something that I feel that I get that really unique perspective having come up through, and then now be in a position to be able to work then with the stakeholders in the other departments to figure out how we can fit the pieces of the puzzle together. So I thank you for that.
Representative Mears.
Thank you, through the chair. I hadn't realized that you guys were having conversations on that level, and that makes me very glad. Thank you.
And I would just note on this slide, this final slide here, these are our canine unit. As you remember, recall, they're located in our institution director's office. But they don't just work in the facilities. So when you look at the amount of contraband that they have seized, this is from out in the communities. They're working with our probation officers. They're working with our postal service, our DEA, to seize this contraband. It's not just coming from the facilities. That being said, I do think it is very important for me to note. I really wish I could put staff pictures all up on here, because on a daily basis, so we have folks that remand themselves into custody, a scheduled remand, and they will come with drugs on their person. And so we have staff that work diligently to catch those drugs as they're coming into our facilities, so they don't get downrange into our facilities. And I'll tell you, we've had some of the biggest drug busts within our facilities in quite some time here in the last couple of weeks. For reference, we had within an 11-day span 622 fentanyl pills. That takes the diligence of our staff to notice notes in listening to phone calls of things that are going on, to look at notes in our computer system, and to pay attention to behaviors and such of folks that are coming in through our back doors. So, that's a piece of what was found. There, methamphetamine, Suboxone, it is incredible the amount of drugs that folks will bring in to try to get into the facilities. And I really have to say, not only to our canine unit, but to our staff who work diligently to try to keep it out of getting it downrange into our facilities.
Just a quick comment. If we could get a breakdown of where or what communities some of these were seized from, that would be, I think, useful, at least for me, and understanding how things are going at YKCC. So, yeah, just a request for that.
To the chair, absolutely.
Any more questions or comments for our presenters this morning? No. Well, Commissioner Winkleman, Deputy Commissioner Wyckoff, and Wilkerson, thank you very much for donating your time this morning and for providing this presentation. I'm sure there's a number of other topics that we'll have you back on, but just wanted to get this over with. Sorry. Just wanted to go through this. To just get the overview and provide our members a chance to just ask some policy based questions. So thank you very much for presenting this morning. So next on the agenda, I think we have, I know for a fact we have HB 70, which is supposed to be presented by Representative Tomaszewski. And I don't see him in the room at the moment. So, take a brief at ease, and we'll just take a brief at ease. All right, we are now back on the record. We will now hear House Bill 70, the bill on municipal tax exemptions. Representative Tomaszewski and Michaela Anderson, staff to Representative Tomaszewski, welcome back. Could you please just provide us a brief recap of HB 70?
Thank you, Chair McCormick. This is Frank Tomaszewski for Representative Tomaszewski for the record. And I'm here with my staff, Michaela Anderson. And Michaela will give us a brief overview on the House Bill 70.
Thank you. For the record, Michaela Anderson, Chief of Staff to Representative Tomaszewski. HB 70 provides more clarification on tax exemptions for nonprofits. Some of the changes include parking lots, space rental, and the real property, which would include food, clothes, shelter, books, health care, that's being given out for free. So our intent with this bill is to provide further clarification to prevent litigation between municipalities and nonprofits in the future.
Thank you. Before we move on to invited testimony, were there any questions for Representative Tomaszewski? Representative Mears.
Thank you. In your presentation, through the chair, in your presentation last week, you said you were working on some bill language with the Fairbanks Sar Borough. What's the status of that?
Through the chair, Representative Mears, we are working with the committee to get that to them so that that can be incorporated, but that would include language that would allow for a grace period on construction. So if there's a property that's owned by a nonprofit, they have 2 years to build on it before that property is not exempt, as well as fundraising ability. And our example of that is the Food Bank's Empty Bowl program, where potters make pottery bowls, and they sell them and all the proceeds go to the food bank, so allowing for activities like that. So we're making that explicit as well, that they can do fundraising, and then also they don't have to build something immediately.
Follow up?
I have a couple. are you working with any other scenarios in Fairbanks for any other nonprofits, or just specifically this facility for the Fairbanks Community Food Bank, right?
Through the chair, Representative Mears, we have looked at other scenarios that are happening, but our primary concern is the food bank.
Have you been in communication with any other municipalities about what the situation is with their tax-exempt status for nonprofits?
Sure. Through the chair, Representative Mears, it would be the same as of today. It would be the same statutes that Fairbanks has, and we have not reached out to other municipalities. It's our understanding that right now this is a Fairbanks-centric issue, but as we said in our presentation last week, if this goes to litigation, it kind of, the dam breaks, and then that opens the door for other municipalities to interpret it that way.
Representative Mears.
Through the chair, have you worked directly with the Fairbanks North Star Borough to resolve this conflict in their code directly?
Sure. Through the chair, Representative Mears, we have discussed with the borough, as well as the food bank has discussed with the borough, to try to resolve this in other ways. And frankly speaking, it just happens. It hasn't happened.
Representative Hemshoot.
Thank you, through the chair. I'm a little out of my depth here, but in Sitka, on the assembly, we occasionally served as a board of equalization. Is that an option in Fairbanks, and has that option been exercised?
So they do have a board of equalization in the assembly. It's just a matter of being able to get that process going, and so far they haven't been able to get that process going. It's been, we have Gene Terrio with us, and he'd probably be able to talk about this a little bit also. There's been recent changes in the way the Board of Equalization works, and so it's not as easy for someone like the property owner to be able to go to the department or the Board of Equalization. It's almost like the first step is going to Superior Court.
Just for the record, I'd like to hear the testimony, and then I might have more questions. Thank you.
All right. So we'll go ahead and move into invited testimony. I believe your first testifier was Bryce Ward, the mayor of the Fairbanks North Star Borough. Is that correct?
Yes.
Okay. Mr. Ward, if you're on the phone, please go ahead and provide your testimony.
Yes, thank you, Chair McCormick and committee members. My name is Bryce Ward. I'm the mayor for the Fairbanks North Star Borough. I'll refer to the borough as the FNSB. First, I'd like to say I appreciate the bill sponsor and the community food bank. I think we all agree that the food bank is a pillar of our community and appreciate the efforts to try to address some of these issues. As currently drafted, HB 70 adds language under 2945030, specifying that state required property tax exemptions, giving clarification on required state exemptions. This means that the borough is required to provide exemptions in exchange for public benefit that qualifies for these charitable organizations. The Alaska Constitution gives direction on this. Article 9, Section 4 provides for an exemption from real property taxes for property that's used, quote, exclusively for nonprofit, religious, charitable, cemetery, or educational purposes as defined by law. Properties owned by nonprofits are not necessarily exempt from taxes. Being owned by a nonprofit is not the only criteria that must be met. In Alaska, as with many other states, it's the use of that property that determines whether or not the property is exempt. Tying tax exemptions to ownership instead of use can have an unintended consequence for undermining public benefit. Just because a property is owned by a nonprofit doesn't mean that it's being exclusively used for a eligible purpose, such as religious, charitable, cemetery, or educational purposes as defined by law. The language in HB 70 is a good start to address some of these issues surrounding the state-required charitable exemptions. However, there are some areas that could be problematic, and the borough has provided the bill sponsor with some suggested language that we think could provide greater clarity to the outcomes for both the food bank and the Fairbanks North Star Borough. The borough supports clarifying statute to give better explanation of what is allowed for charitable use as defined by law. And we are actively working with to address these issues with the bill sponsor and the food bank. I think it's important to also point out there was some comments made earlier about the BOE. In the Fairbanks North Star Borough, the Board of Equalization is reserved for valuation cases. If it's a matter of taxability, as according to the law, we refer them directly to the Superior Court. It's my understanding that some communities do things a little bit differently, but in the Fairbanks North Star Borough, we refer issues of taxability to the court system. I am available to take questions. We also do have our borough attorney, Jill Dolan, online if there's questions from a legal perspective.
Representative Hemshue.
Thank you, through the chair. Thank you, Mayor Ward, for being with us today. I will confess I'm struggling with this bill because it is so localized, at least the current application of it is so localized, and I really appreciate local control. So for your Board of Equalization, can the duties of that board be changed? How many cases like this are coming up? Would it be an undue burden for your Board of Equalization to expand to resolve this problem at the local level?
I think it would certainly be a question for the Assembly from the administration's perspective. When we do look at the duties of the Board of Equalization versus the issues of taxability, equalization is an issue of value. How much is the property worth? The issues of whether or not a property is taxable really come down to interpretation of law, and it's at least the administration's opinion that a court system is best equipped to be able to adequately and appropriately and equitably administer that law across the state.
Representative Mears.
Thank you for joining us, Mayor, through the chair. I had got these fancy statute books in my office, so decided to look some up and make some notes. So under 2945050, it's the optional exemptions and exclusions for municipalities. And B is a municipality by ordinance. One, classify and exempt from taxation. A, the property of an organization not organized for business or profit-making purposes and used exclusively for community purposes. There's a little bit more, but my interpretation of this statute is that the borough has the opportunity to exempt such properties if you so choose by statute. So you have the opportunity to resolve this issue on the borough level. Am I interpreting this correctly?
Yes, Representative Mears, you are correct that there are optional exemptions that are available for community purpose that are executable at the local level. We do require that the property owner file an application, And I believe that has been communicated to the food bank that if they are interested in a community purpose exemption outside of the state required exemptions, that they're welcome to apply for that.
Thank you.
Are there any further questions for Mayor Ward? Mayor Ward, thank you very much for your testimony this morning. Representative Tomaszewski, I see we have quite a few people signed up for testimony. Who would you like to testify next?
Sam Kirsten.
Okay, all right. Miss Kirsten, are you on the line?
Yes, I am. Thank you.
Please state your name for the record and feel free to begin your testimony.
Thank you. I appreciate the time. My name is Samantha Kirstein. I work as the Community Development Director of the Fairbanks Community Food Bank. I've worked for them for 32 years. And my testimony is that for all of this time until 2022, we have had exempt properties and we have applied for the exemption. Last year, we were astonished to find that that we were not exempt fully. We have partial exemptions on some of the pieces that we have. And so I believe that we have worked with our borough to try to make sure that they understand the work that we do, and it is for community purpose only. And so that's really all I can add to the conversation. I appreciate the time that you're giving to this discussion.
Thank you very much for your testimony this morning, Ms. Kirstein. Are there any questions? Okay, moving on.
Ann Weaver.
I don't see them online.
And then we have also Gene Terrio in the room.
Okay. Mr. Terrio, would you like to come forward and provide your testimony?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I'm Gene Terrio. I currently serve as the president for the board of directors for the Fairbanks Community Food Bank. I'm pleased to be here to represent them. I do this work for them pro bono. I get no salary. I get no reimbursement for any expense to be in Juneau to look out for issues for them. It's been a pleasure to serve on the Fairbanks Food Bank board in our community, having lived there all my life. I don't think there's a charitable organization in the community that has as widespread support as the food bank. Just recently, I just want to touch quickly. Recently, in response to the food shortage that is people are experiencing around the state, the governor did release some emergency money. The Fairbanks Community Food Bank did qualify and receive about $400,000 of that money. And I wanted to let you know that what we've done is try and partner with other entities in the state of Alaska that have supply of food in the Matsu. We partner with the Matsu Food Bank down there, supply of vegetables that are grown locally. We have partnered with entities around the state, fisheries in Sitka, securing thousands of pounds of flash frozen fish, bringing up to our food bank and then distributing them. Although we are called the Fairbanks Community Food Bank, we actually serve a huge portion of the state, pretty much the entire northern half of the state. And for example, the frozen fish that we have received are sent out to villages as far as Arctic Village. We sent 21 50-pound cases of frozen fish up there. Holy Cross, Huslia, Nikolai. We really do provide facilities that serve a huge geographic area outside the Fairbanks North Star Borough. As Ms. Kirsten indicated, the food bank is 40 years old. We have never been levied a property tax against any of our facilities until last year. And basically we're dismayed to know that happened. There was a group, the Foraker group, was aware that there was sort of a growing possibility that property tax would be levied against nonprofits. And so they've been watching that for a couple of years, and it just appears that the Fairbanks borough is the first one to levy property tax. In 2022, in three different sites that the food bank owns, one of our original buildings, which we currently own, but we lease to the Literacy Council, another 501c3 in Fairbanks, a separate warehouse that we own that also has some meeting space in the front of it, and then our main facility and a property that's sort of kitty-corner where we just developed and built a new warehouse. Those are the three properties that we got assessed tax on. And the total tax bill was about $8,200. That's not crushing for our organization, but when I am in Fairbanks, I routinely, on a weekly basis, sign checks. And in the middle of the winter, our energy bill for just our main facility can be $15,000 to $16,000 a month. So $8,000 is not immaterial to the operation and needs of the entity. Just for an example, and one that we're very concerned about, in our denial letter from the assessor last year, and this is on the one property that I indicated has warehouse space and then some meeting space in the front. For, I think, 32 years, we have been operating this empty bowl fundraiser. The Potters Guild in Fairbanks, over the course of the year, they throw different bowls. They donate them, so it's all volunteer time. They pay for all the material. They donate the bowls. We display them then in one of our facilities. People come in. It's sort of an open house. People bid on the bowls. We might have a mining company that even bids $1,000 on a bowl just as a means of contributing to the food bank. That fundraiser was held previously at this warehouse that has this meeting space in the front. And as a result of that, as part of our denial letter, and I'll read from the denial, in April, it hosted the Empty Bowls Potters Guild fundraiser event. And again, in June 26th, there was a lemonade stand fundraiser also at the facility. All uses of the property must be for the direct and primary exempt purpose. Property used by a charitable organization to raise money for that group's charitable purpose is not exempt, since the property's direct and primary use is fundraising and not the charitable function itself. So this determination says basically that if you're raising money, you're not feeding people. And if your charitable purpose in the facility is to take food in for free and give it away for free, but you're engaged in an enterprise other than that, then you potentially put your property tax exemption at risk. And on that particular property, then what they did is they measured the square footage of the space in front of the warehouse, and we had to pay property tax on that. Now, just last Saturday, we held the Empty Bowls fundraiser again, but this time it was back at our main warehouse building. Sunday paper, front page of the paper, bowls displayed throughout the warehouse space where the food is sorted, stored, the boxes are prepared for distribution, and the people lined up in the morning to come through. Again, a tremendous sort of open house for the food bank. But now we're seriously concerned that having used our main facility for this fundraiser, basically the entire downstairs, according to this denial letter, we have put our main facility at risk to be charged property tax this year. And basically, if we're unhappy with the denial that we get, just like last year, this coming year, our only recourse is to go into court. We don't have the resources to go into court. It's tremendously expensive. You get no quick decision from it. And we just don't think that our energies should be diverted in that direction. And it was for that reason that in 2022, we just paid the property taxes. And moved on, figuring out we would just try and deal with this situation. And if the suggestion was that we needed clarification in the statute, that's what we would request. We were pleased to work with former Representative LeBron while he was still in office. And basically what he did is he took our denial determination, worked with Ledge Legal, and came up with the wording for House Bill 70 that is before you. I knew, having spent, you know, basically my entire life working in the building, that we would probably have to modify that language because it was drafted so tightly to the food bank's specifics that it may, in fact, cause problems for other nonprofits. So we are sensitive to the fact that there are other nonprofits out there that operate all kinds of different enterprises for charitable good. And so we're pleased that the mayor did come forward and suggest a more nuanced way to approach this. And his suggestion was to really look at the word use and bring some further definition to, you know, that word use and what would be sort of de minimis use that would still be allowed that would not cause your operation to kick it into a taxable category, basically. And we think what he has suggested perhaps is a more artful way to do that. It basically adds on to the existing statute to bring some further definition to that language where it says exclusively used. I don't think you want to remove the word exclusive because you don't want to blow things wide open so that the statute can be misused. But I think there needs to be a recognition that a food bank using the warehouse on a weekend to host a fundraiser, you know, that is a de minimis type of use. The proceeds are being used to underpin the economic needs of the charitable purpose, and that type of activity should be allowed. In the recent response to the food shortage, you know, we're pleased that we have the infrastructure to help the state to meet those basic food and nutritional needs across the state. But there's a tremendous expense that goes along with that. We have this warehouse space. We're pleased to provide the warehouse space. We never know when Federal Foods will show up in bulk or there will be a need for us to buy 40,000 pounds of frozen salmon from Sitka or 30,000 pounds of bycatch from a processor out of Seattle. We make sure that the community on behalf of the needs in Fairbanks and the northern half of the state have those facilities in place. But we need some help to make sure that we don't get subjected to property tax as we try and provide those critical needs. Otherwise, it puts our operation in economic jeopardy. Thank you.
Thank you for your testimony this morning, Mr. Terrio. Vice Chairman Kate.
So I have three questions for you, Mr. Terrio, or maybe for Representative Tomaszewski. How much food do you suppose $8,200 can buy for hungry people?
Mr. Chairman, I can give you a direct response. Recently, we did buy, I think, 31,000 pounds of that bycatch out of Seattle. There's no cost for the fish itself or the canned fish, but it cost us $8,000 in freight for that 31,000 pounds of food.
So through the chair, follow up.
Yes, please.
Thank you. So 31,000 pounds of canned salmon bycatch cost $8,000 to get that up here to feed hungry people. I appreciate that. What changed in 2022 that all of a sudden caused them after 30 some plus years of working tax free? What changed in 2022 to cause the Fairbanks North Star Borough to levy a tax?
It appears it was just a reinterpretation of the statute and application of the statute. I did recently check with the Department of DCCED to see if the state assessor had somehow messaged that the taxes or the exemptions were being administered improperly. The response that I got back just yesterday was there had been no such indication from the State Department.
Okay.
Follow up.
Thanks. So nothing really changed, and they started to. Can we get a copy of the letter? I didn't see one in the package, so I'd love to see a copy of the letter as part of this. It just seems, It seems a little much to have to do this via statute. you know, it's I'm just curious why it's coming up a lemonade stand and a charitable food bowl. I mean, the Fairbanks, so to be clear, the food bank is a nonprofit, which means it's there for community develop. It's not a not-for-profit, which is just typically like a its own little club. It's a nonprofit, which means it's there for the community, not for just the church or just a small group of people, right?
Yeah. And Mr. Chairman, that's true. And I can certainly provide you a copy of the denial determination. And just to give a quick summary of that, the property that we leased to the Literacy Council, and of all of the food bank properties, we only lease to other qualified nonprofits. That's just a choice that we've made. The Literacy Council operates a used bookstore. And so what was determined there was that, well, the selling of books is not teaching people how to read. And so they measured the square footage of the bookshop, basically, and we had to pay property tax on that. Because we had no idea that that building would be taxed, we did not build into the lease that the lessor would have to pay any property taxes. And so we, the building owner, we basically had to eat it, and we paid the property taxes for the Literacy Council. So that gives you an idea on that particular property. I've already talked about the other warehouse. We call it the clubhouse, but it's just warehouse space, and then it's got meeting space up front, and how they measured that basic non-warehouse space. The other property that we got taxed on was not our main building, but kitty corner to that, we owned a piece of property. It was donated to us, and we were in the process of building a new warehouse. The new warehouse is now built, and we're putting the final finishing touches on it. In fact, but in 2022, we had dug the foundation. We had put the gravel in, letting it settle over the winter, getting prepared to build. And basically, even though we showed that we had used that property for Connex storage, in heavy snow years, for our snow dump, so our parking lot would not be, covered by the snow. The determination was, well, yeah, we see a foundation, but it's not property that's being used to feed people, and therefore you have to pay property tax on it until you put it into that operation. So again, we appreciate the fact that the mayor suggested some language that would have this 2-year, window of opportunity. And I do understand that at the local government, you don't want a nonprofit somehow sitting on property, speculating. It's just, fallow. So we want to strike a balance here that's fair and something that's not subject to abuse.
Can I get one more follow-up? Thank you. So the Literacy Council is also a 501c3. What do they do when they sell a book? Obviously, they sell it at a much reduced price. It's a book for children or for people that can't afford to buy a regular book, or what do they do with their profits?
Their profits are used to support their charitable function. However, the books are, anybody can go in and buy them. So it's not just to underprivileged. They do sell them at a reduced price, but that gives you an idea of one of the things that we do want to be sensitive to. The language talks about, an entity operating a store, getting stuff that's donated and selling it below market price. As I thought about other nonprofits, the Girl Scouts in Fairbanks, they own their building. Girl Scouts sell cookies, and I know since my daughter was a Girl Scout up to getting her gold award, I think you can go to the main office there and you can buy some cookies. Well, they're definitely not donated, and they're definitely not selling them below market price. So we don't want to trigger, have an unanticipated consequence and impact them. So, again, I think there's a more nuanced way to go at this that's less sort of surgically specific to the food bank and the Literacy Council, but would allow, other nonprofits like that I think collectively you would probably agree, that's the legitimate fundraising to support their charitable purpose.
Thank you.
Are there any more questions for Mr. Terrio? Mr. Terrio, thank you very much for your testimony this morning. I believe that concludes our invited testimony for this morning. So, with that in mind, Representative Tomaszewski and Ms. Anderson, thank you for presenting on HB 70 this morning and for inviting your testifiers. HB 70 will be held over. We will now take a brief at ease while we transition to hear HB 134. Brief at ease. All right, we are now back on the record. I would like to welcome Representative Cologne and Maggie Elliott, staff to Representative Cologne. Please begin your presentation on HB 134.
All right, so for the record, I'm Representative Cologne, Julie Cologne. I represent House District 11. Thank you, McCormick Chair, or Chair McCormick, and the committee for letting us present HB 134 this morning. I have Maggie Elliott, my staff, and I also have Errol Champion, Managing Broker from Race Realty, for any questions, and he is able to give you a little bit broader perspective on the subject. So HB 134 prohibits the state and local governments from imposing real estate transfer taxes, fees, and other assessments on sales, grants, assignments, or transfer of real property. A transfer fee is an additional cost that is increasingly being assessed by local and state governments for property transactions in other states. So when this was brought to me, one of the reasons, well, the main reason why I wanted to carry the bill was housing is a problem in the state. We all know that. The housing crunch is pretty bad, and so it's certainly a problem in Anchorage. And I saw if we move towards what a lot of lower 48 states do and tax the transfer of real estate, so every time you buy a house, a title is transferred, there would be a tax on that. That just adds to the obstacles that we're finding in housing. So I know that there's been a lot of talk about, and I've asked this question too, as far as local control versus state control. But if you can see in Anchorage that housing is not just a local control or local issue. So when communities throughout the state are having housing problems, it affects other communities. And so this is not a tax that is imposed right now by anybody. This is a kind of a preventative action to make sure that we're not adding to the problem by the state or localities adding this tax to the purchase of a house. It also is a disincentive for home builders. Because that they would pay the tax when they acquire the property, then when they sell the property, then that buyer pays the tax. And so I was really just interested in trying to protect the housing industry right now. We're struggling, certainly in Anchorage, but in the state. And a transfer tax, in my mind, is something that would not help the situation. And it currently will not touch any property taxes that are happening now. It doesn't designate anything regarding property taxes to other to the communities right now. This only addresses the transfer of a title. So that's the overview of the tax, and I can have my staff go through the sectional or questions. Up to you, Chair.
Let's go through the sectional, and then we'll open the floor for questions.
Good morning, Chair McCormick and Vice Chair McCabe and members of the Community and Regional Affairs Committee. For the record, my name is Maggie Elliott, staff to Julie Cologne. I will now walk you through the sectional analysis of House Bill 134. Section 1 starts on page 1, line 5 through 7, conforming to Section 4. This section amends AS 2910-256 to add the provisions of this bill to the limitation of home rule power statute. Section 2 starts on page 1, line 8 through 9, conforming to Section 6. This section amends AS 2910-257 to add the provisions of this bill to the limitation of home rule power statute. Section 3 starts on page 1, line 10, to page 2, line 2, conforming language to amend AS 2945650A to add new subsection L of this bill to the statutes regarding borough sales
and use tax. Section 4 starts on page 2, lines 3 through 5, amends AS 2945650 to add new subsection L to the borough sales and use tax statute to provide that a borough may not levy or collect sales tax on the transfer of real property. Section 5 starts on page 2, lines 6 through 11, conforming the section 6. This section amends AS 29400700A to add new section subsection H to the bill to the power of levy statute. Section 6 starts on page 2, line 12 through 14, amends AS 2945700 to add a new subsection H to the power of levy statute, which states that a city may not levy or collect a sales or use tax on the transfer of real property. Section 7 starts on page 2, line 15 through 17, adds a new section to Article 3, no tax on real property transfers, which stipulates that the state may not levy or collect on sales or use tax on the real transfer of real property. Section 8 starts on page 2, line 16 through 19, repealed section related to municipal taxation of mobile telecommunications. Thank you.
Thank you for providing that overview. Are there any questions from committee members before we move on to invited testimony? Representative McKay.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Through the chair, the definition of real property is quite a bit bigger than just residential homes, I think. Maybe you could talk about commercial real estate, or there's other, the whole list of definitions of real property. Are we just talking about houses, or we're talking about a lot of other things? I think Representative Kulo, maybe you could talk about that. Are we addressing a huge amount of material here, or just houses? You see what I'm saying?
I do.
Okay.
I do. I might ask Errol Flynn to come, or Errol to come up and speak a little bit more about that. But the intention obviously is residential housing. That's the biggest. That's where my focus is. And we can definitely go through, and maybe we can get the drafter on the phone too to make sure that the way the bill's written is that to make sure that we're addressing that one aspect of the transfer. So I don't know if it would be okay if I could get Errol to come maybe fill in any gaps for that.
Yeah, just concerned that it says real property. It doesn't actually, right. That could be a whole lot of stuff.
Yep.
Be careful here. We're not biting off more than we think we are.
Absolutely.
Thank you. Sure.
Thank you for being here this morning. If you could just state your name for the record.
Well, good morning. My name is Errol Champion. As I was introduced, I am the managing broker at Coldwell Banker Reach Realty here in Juneau, but I'm also chair of the Legislative Issues Committee for Alaska Realtors. And thank you, Chair McCormick, Vice Chair McCabe, and all the rest of the members of the committee. I couldn't give you exactly the ratio, but in terms of real property transactions that are made in Alaska, probably less than 10% of that volume is commercial property. The rest of it, 90% of it, would be residential. There's no possible way that you could define it, because something might be sold as commercial property and then turn around and be developed into residential, multifamily. There's just no statute. But the concern is there's 35 states that have levied the requirement of disclosure, and once they have the disclosed transaction price, then they're in a position to levy a transfer fee or an excise tax. And that's what happens, and that gets added on to the cost of real property.
Okay,
Representative McKay.
Yeah, thank you. Through the chair, I the 10% of, if I sell an office building that's worth, $50 million, I'm just picking an example out of midair, and I don't oppose the legislation, don't get me wrong. I just wonder how would this legislation deal with that transaction? Just picking an example of something in that 10%.
Representative McKay, through the chair, there's no way to to split that out. I mean, it would, real property would be exempt. I can just say that it's the commercial and industrial properties in the state are in terms of volume, are very, very minuscule to compare to residential sales.
Okay. Representative Hemshute.
I think my question is for the bill's sponsor, actually, so I can hold off.
Okay. Representative McKay.
Thank you. Mr. Champion, I'm wondering about the cost in the other states. What do they normally charge? I mean, is it really 10%, or is there a certain percentage that other states have started levying? Maybe that's for Representative Cologne, too. She's done a lot of research, so I'm curious.
Through the chair, Representative McCabe, the 10% was the ratio of commercial property to residential. The highest transfer fee that I'm aware of is in Washington State. I believe there's a chart that I have provided. I don't know if it's in your packet here, but it varies. Some states have a state transfer fee, a county transfer fee, and a municipal transfer fee, such as California. Some places it's a flat rate transfer fee, but the issue that the realtors in Alaska are supportive of this bill is simply to eliminate any costs that increase the cost of acquiring a home.
And can I add to that through the chair to Representative McCabe, again, Representative Coulomb. For the record. So when I looked at it, I looked at Washington and Colorado had the higher rates. It varied all the way from 0.1 per $100,000 dollars all the way to 3.5 per level. And so some of those states, as he was alluding to, some of those states you have, it may be, you know, 0.1 or 0.2. But they have three levels of government that's charging it, so it can go up to 10%. It can get pretty costly. So it would be a municipality, a county, and a state transfer tax. And so some of the states that it was hard because I had gotten questioned about, you know, potential lost revenue to a city. It's hard to really determine that because of the way transfer fees are structured and the amount of households you have. But I would say, you know, between 0.1 and 3.5, I would say, for one level of transfer tax per $100,000 of home.
Follow up?
Yes, Vice Chair McCabe.
So, thanks for that. And who typically pays that? Or is that negotiated in the closing agreement? Is it the buyer, the seller?
I'll let Errol answer that first because he has more experience with it.
Representative McCabe, through the chair, most sellers will recognize that they're going to have to pay that, so they're going to add to the asking price of the home. I guess the question would be then when the buyer secures the mortgage, that's going to be built into it. But the reason they like the transfer fee is it's a one-time charge. It's collected by the escrow office. It's not like you're having a monthly payment on it. So I think you would have to say the seller is going to be paying it. It's going to be extracted out of his proceeds at closing.
Mm-hmm. Thanks.
Are there any further questions for Mr. Champion? Okay. Mr. Champion, I'd just like to provide you the opportunity to provide any comments or remarks on HB 134. I think we kind of threw you right into questions, so I just wanted to afford you the opportunity if you had any remarks.
Well, Chair McCormick, thank you very much. You know, this has been an issue because it's widespread across the United States that our committee and the Alaska Realtors have monitored. Only recently did the city of Juneau pass an ordinance that required the disclosure for real property, and the compliance with the Juneau ordinance was so poor that they adopted a second ordinance that levied a $50 a day fine if you failed to share what you bought or sold a piece of property. Last summer, the citizens signed an initiative petition recalling that ordinance, and it was adopted by the citizens by a 10% margin of vote. So the ordinance is now off of the books. But this simply said to all of us in the real estate industry and home builders and contractors and many others that, hey, the inclination is there to go after the sale of real property. It's happened in 35 other states, and there's just simply no reason. There's 12 states that do not charge or do not require disclosure, and therefore, without disclosure, you can't have a transfer fee. So our preference is that we remain a non-disclosed state. We've been non-disclosed since statehood. Section 22 in Article 1 of our Constitution speaks to privacy. It doesn't single out real property, but it in essence says that Alaskans are entitled to certain rights and privacies. And so we just feel that real property transfer fees, which would be based on the disclosure, is a violation of the Alaska Constitution. And we are wanting to continue that approach and make sure we remain non-disclosed and that we aren't assessing fees.
Mr. Champion, thank you for taking your questions this morning and for providing your testimony. I want to just quickly open the floor for any further questions for Representative Cologne, but just do kind of want to keep an eye on the clock. We do have Representative Dunbar here, excuse me, Senator Dunbar here to present an SB 77. So, but if there are any questions before we conclude with this bill, Representative Hinshute.
Thank you. I have two questions for the bill sponsor, if I can find them. I've written notes everywhere here. Thank you, through the chair. Representative Klum, I'm trying to understand, does this bill also say that we will remain a non-disclosure state? Because I read it, and I need to go deeper on it, but my understanding is it says we will not tax transfers. Does it say that we will also remain a non-disclosure state?
Representative Hinshute, through the chair, no, it doesn't address the disclosure part. We're simply addressing the transfer tax. Whether a community wants to make mandatory disclosure or not is still up to each community.
Follow up.
Thank you. Yes, through the chair. So this bill would prohibit municipalities from levying a tax. But doesn't this list talk about a state tax? And so my question is this bill intended to prevent a state tax from being imposed because it talks about municipalities? So we're just skipping the state part, which is what's addressed in this list here, and going straight to the municipal level. Why is that?
Okay. Through the chair, Representative Hinshute. So it does address the borough, it addresses the state, and addresses the municipality. And I can follow up with you on which sections do that. But in Section 5 is talking about the borough. The state is on Section
L
2-3.
Section 4.
So it's all levels.
So through the chair, I guess I would just comment, if we gutted everything out that dealt with municipalities and stuck with the state, I'd be much more interested in this. Mm-hmm. I'm a strong proponent of local control and letting, so for example, in Sitka, we can't build a house in another town or rent a house in another place and drive to where our work is in Sitka. What we have is what we have. And so I'm equally protective of our housing stock in Sitka. Mm-hmm. So I get the point here. At the same time, we also, I think, are very capable of deciding what is the right taxation for our community. And I value that local decision. Mm-hmm. And I'm not crazy about extra regulation where we don't need it. So I'll be thinking about this. Thank you.
All right. Thank you, Representative Hinshute.
Any further questions for Representative Cologne? Okay. Well, Representative Cologne, thank you for presenting on your bill this morning. And Mr. Champion for your testimony and answering our questions as well. We We'll now hold over HB 134, and we will take a super duper brief at ease while we transition to hear SB 77. We are now back on the record. I apologize to the sports staff. I didn't check with you guys if we're ready, but here we go. We are now joined by Senator Dunbar and Aliana Salangut, staff to Senator Dunbar. Senator Dunbar, I think we're decently apprised of this bill as we had a presentation on 84, which is a companion bill. So I think what would be useful this morning, if you could just maybe speak to what some of the differences are as it went through the Senate.
Oh, thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you for members of the committee. This is exciting for me. It's my first time being here in the House. I really appreciate your hearing this bill. And as you mentioned, you already did a presentation, or I already heard HB 84, the companion bill by Rep. Sumner. And I want to thank members of this committee, Representative Mears and Vice Chair McCabe, for co-sponsoring that bill. So on the Senate side, we passed this, obviously, a couple days ago. There were several changes made. So I'll just say, just to frame things again, these are two optional tools that municipalities can choose to use or to not use. And so it sort of generally follows the principle of local control. However, there were a few more changes made that sort of tighten up that a little bit. First, there was a cap on the blight tax to 50% of a property's annual assessed property tax. The prior version didn't have any kind of cap. And I know 50% can seem like a lot, but in other parts of the country, it can be two or even three times. And so it's much lower than this tool as it's used in most other parts of the country. I felt that was appropriate given Alaska's general aversion to taxation. But also, you know, this is a reasonably powerful tool, and so we want to have protections built in. As you know, it also forbids a primary residence being the subject of the blight tax. It's a really, I think, important point that has been lost in some of the media coverage, that a primary residence cannot be subject to this tax. On the Senate floor, Senator Keel made an amendment, which did pass, that changed that slightly. So now it's a primary residence owner-occupied primary residence. That is, it's the property owner that is paying the property tax. If it's their primary residence, then it cannot be subject to the blight tax. Two other changes, another by Senator Keel, allowed home rule and first-class cities inside boroughs to implement the blight tax. That was simply, there was a certain type of local government that was inadvertently left out of the draft. And so it was just, the intent is any local government that currently has a property tax could use these tools should they choose. There were two other smaller amendments by Senator Hughes. I thought I had those here. One was the blight tax may be removed once remediation redevelopment has begun as opposed to when it is completed. So at the beginning process where the blight tax would be removed, you can immediately have that property tax removed as opposed to waiting until the remediation has been completed. And I think that makes sense. I mean, we want to see good faith efforts to remediate these properties. And the last change was just clarifying. It had said in there, the prior version, that a blight tax could not be assessed on a blighted property. On a primary residence. We went a step further on the Senate floor. Senator Hughes made an amendment that said you couldn't even designate something as blighted if it was someone's primary residence, let alone impose the tax. And that was just a clarification. It was never the case. It was never the intention of the bill, at least on my side, that that this process would apply to those primary residences. So those were the main changes, and happy to speak to those or any other part of the bill that someone would like to speak to.
Thank you, Senator Dunbar. Vice Chair McCabe, did you?
Thank you. Senator Dunbar, I'm curious, and you probably know this because of your previous job on the Assembly, but when Anchorage adopts an ordinance, does it automatically go to the voters, or is that just something the Assembly can do?
It doesn't. Most ordinances do not go to the voters, and it doesn't happen automatically. Well, with some exceptions. So a bond, for example, does. But a typical ordinance, you know, changing the animal control code, for example, that does not go to the voters. Although that in that example, animal control is extremely controversial, and so sometimes it ends up with the voters. But no, there are two ways to get something before the voters. The Assembly can do it themselves, or you can have a citizens initiative to put something before the voters.
Follow up,
please.
Okay, so next question. And this is kind of following up on that. The Assembly could adopt an ordinance with no voter input that designates blighted as somebody that didn't mow their lawn, for instance, if they really, really wanted a building. In other words, I'm trying to find some protections in here for a homeowner that maybe his home has fallen into a little bit of disrepair, maybe it looks terrible, or maybe it's just in the way. And the Assembly decides it's in a way, and they could adopt an ordinance with no public input to remove this person from his building or separate him from his building. So I'm curious what you think blighted should mean.
So in that case, I first want to stress that you said, you know, a person in their home, they can't be subject to this. So that's one. The second is just removing something for public purpose is not blighted. That what you're describing is someone help me with the term. It's not foreclosed. Eminent domain. Thank you, Representative Mears, which has, of course, all these different court protections, very difficult process. I remember we did it once to get a sliver of land from people's parking lots for the Spinard Road, and it was quite difficult. There is a built-in appeals process here. And then I would say, you know, the primary check on assemblies and mayors in Alaskan local government is the ability to vote them out. And I think that we've seen cases where folks do something that the people don't appreciate and they vote them out. That being said, Senator Hughes had put forward on the floor a definition for blighted. I had only seen that definition an hour before I got to the floor, and I didn't feel it was appropriate to amend it on the floor. Some other states have, and local governments have done definitions for what blighted means exactly. We have some invited testimony from some folks. I don't know if you are willing to hear it, Chair McCormick, today. But I think the Alaska Municipal League in particular has expressed that they would prefer if local governments had the ability to define it themselves. I'll say that we all received an email, at least on our side, from a out-of-state organization that wanted to put a definition in. And it was interesting because the definition they chose to say this is a definition we want from Texas was much broader than I think any assembly in Alaska would be willing to accept. And so it's sort of an interesting case where people want it defined, but then as soon as they define it, I think you'll find some flaws with that. And so if we are going to define it, I think we have to be really thoughtful in doing so. And I'm not completely opposed to that, but we have to be really thoughtful. And I prefer local control in most cases. I mean, I think Alaskans like to have their government be as close to the people as they can. And we here in Juneau dictating what people in Big Lake or Upyallik or Unalaska Ducks Harbor are doing, I think is, is sometimes frowned upon.
Vice Chair McCabe.
So I appreciate that, and I like the local control thing. Unfortunately, there are a number of places in the unorganized boroughs, and Big Lake's a good example. Who controls Big Lake? The Matsu Borough, the Big Lake Community Council. So yeah. I suspect we're going to land on having a definition somewhere. There are a number of states. I've read Michigan's, Wisconsin's, Virginia's, Texas. Mm-hmm. And I'm wondering if maybe having a floor. So blighted means, at the very least, it means this, but a community could increase that if they wanted to. But just one of the things that we were discussing yesterday, actually. So,
yeah,
I would, I guess I'll just leave it at that, we are a little bit different than other states. It's one thing, that just because we're so spread out in different communities. So what's a community? Talkeetna is a census designated area. Well, what does that mean? Yeah. How do we control that through their community council, which is an incorporated community council? So little bit different, and it might take some state floor, if you will, to resolve that. But
thank you, Mr. Vice Chair. May I, Mr. Chair? So through the chair, Mr. Vice Chair, I think that there is some truth to that, although I actually don't know. This only applies to entities that can impose a property tax, and so I think some of those areas probably can't do that. But it's certainly something that I think that we should have a thoughtful discussion about. I would also point to Pennsylvania, I think, has a pretty good definition as well with some interesting language in there.
Thanks.
Representative McKay, did you have a question, comment?
Well, thank you, Mr. Chairman, and through the chair, Senator, thank you for bringing this forward today. I like to use examples as ways to test legislation. And, our job in state government, I think, is to pass laws, of course, but it's also to protect our citizens from overzealous and overambitious local governments. So let's say I've spent my life building a business in our state's largest city. All my assets are in that business. Let's say it's a retail store downtown Anchorage, and along comes a pandemic, and the local government decides to lock down my business for a year or more, and I'm unable to pay the bills, and my business that I've invested my entire life savings into becomes blighted by a definition, again, set by the same group. And I'm forced to, they raise the taxes on it through a bill like this, and I'm forced to sell, and then I'm left with nothing. So I think we need to be very careful about establishing laws like this, because it could have unintended consequences, because that very thing did happen. And I like to use examples to illustrate that unintended consequences of things like this can happen, and it can be very destructive. So I think we need to go forward on this with a lot of caution. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Yes, may I answer that, Mr. Chair?
Senator Dunbar.
Thank you, Representative McKay. I appreciate that that concern. And I think that's one of the reasons why I welcome the amendment that allowed for a just initiating redevelopment or renovation, remediation, sorry, rather than completing it. I think what we're looking for is a good faith effort. You know, there are a number of properties, and again, this doesn't apply to primary residences, but if you go throughout Anchorage, we had a very troublesome property in Midtown Anchorage, for example, a hotel that sat abandoned for many years, owned by an out-of-state landowner that became a center of criminal activity and was a huge fire hazard. Those are the kind of properties we're thinking about, long-term vacancies, things that fall into tremendous disrepair that become a blight on their neighborhoods. I'm not aware of a property in downtown Anchorage that sort of went through the process you described, where a landowner, because of the pandemic, forced to close, never reopened, never received any financial aid available, and then the property became anything remotely like blighted. And even if it had, you could, and I'm not denying to you that there are folks that, I'll just say that, a good faith effort to begin the process of making something not a danger or an imposition on the neighborhood in which it's in would alleviate these taxes. It's not intended to be a tool that leads to foreclosure. It's not intended to be a tool that is punitive. It's intended to be a tool that either leads to remediation or perhaps a changing of hands at fair market value to a owner that can do that remediation. And I'll say in some of the neighborhoods that I go door knocking in, you'll find sometimes the hotel or an apartment building that is no longer capable of being lived in. You know, it has fallen into such disrepair. And I want to get those properties back on the market and increase our housing stock in this state.
Representative McKay.
Well, I mean, at the Midtown Hotel you're referring to, Senator, the problem got taken care of without this legislation. So,
Can I speak that?
And, please, you know, good intentions are fine, but laws don't always respect good intentions.
So in that case, I'm sorry, Mr. Chair, may I speak to that?
Yes.
Representative McKay, through the chair, in that specific case, the assembly actually passed an ordinance that imposed some fees for boarding up and that kind of thing if you didn't secure your property. That wasn't enough. And so that property owner happened to have another property downtown, and there was a very complicated negotiation between the city government and that property owner to talk about the deteriorated property tax exemption, which this body also passed into law, so that they could get a tax break on their downtown property, and it was sort of part of a broader agreement that they also knocked down Midtown. So you can see the ways that these kind of tools have to be used, and over the course of years. I mean, I would say also in that particular case, that building sat vacant and was a danger to the community far, far longer than the residents of Midtown wanted it to be. And so perhaps this would have led to a more positive outcome for the city a little bit faster. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Yeah, thank you, Senator Dunbar. So I just want to be respectful of everyone's time. We're coming up on 10 o'clock here. I do know you have some invited testimony. If we want to get to that, we can, but we are planning to have you back on Tuesday, so we could also have that testimony then. So I'll just defer to your preference.
Mr. Chair, at least for perhaps Mr. Andreessen, who is in the room, perhaps he could speak a little bit?
Sure. Yeah.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
For the record, Nils Andreessen, I'm the executive director of the Alaska Municipal League, and realizing that the committee is coming up on time, I will be brief. We do view this bill as currently drafted in support of local control and local community redevelopment priorities. It provides local decision making around local issues. And I appreciate the context that each legislator here brings to the table. We're thinking about all communities in Alaska and all the city councils and borough assemblies, those with property taxes to whom this applies, and to empower them to make sure that their communities are whole, that properties have value, and that at the same time they're able to protect vulnerable populations within their communities and to advance quality of life, public health, and public safety. So we view this bill in its entirety as a tool in the toolbox to advance so many of the priorities that this committee and our members have articulated over the years. Thank you.
Thank you for your testimony, Mr. Andreessen. So I see the Senator, I think the Senator has left us, but, oh, you're hiding behind Nils. Okay. Well, Senator Dunbar, thank you for coming to introduce SB 77 this afternoon. We will hold this over. Next week on Tuesday, we will be hearing SB 77 again with public testimony. Also on that day, we'll be having a second hearing for HB 99 with public testimony. I'm setting an amendment deadline for both SB 77 and HB 99 for Monday at 3:30. Then tentatively on Thursday, we will be hearing a presentation on Village Safe Water. The time is 10:01 a.m., and this meeting of the House Community and Regional Affairs Committee is now adjourned. Thank you very much.